Hey there.
Chris, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fantastic. Great to see you.
You too. You got the pro mic. I like it.
How do you not have a pro mic? What is this?
I do. I'm just at home. That is, of course, what you've got there is the industry gold standard mic of choice.
The
But
pod. Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
I'm in my little home office right now, so I don't have a. This is actually pretty good. This is for travel. This is a little Apogee hype mic. Works pretty darn good.
You know what I've been doing? Because I've been traveling and doing some podcasting. And you know what I've found works really great is an SM58, like works killer for podcasting.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. I mean that. Yeah, that's like that's the mic that you can just kick the shit out of, and
Like
it never complains, and it always does its job.
It's like I was doing these panels at some conferences and I was like, what am I going to bring? And I threw like four of them in my bag and I
Nice.
listened back to the audio and I was like, these sound incredible. Like,
Yeah, there
they're
you go. Plus,
why
you
would
can get up and, if you got a long enough cable, you can get up and walk around the stage and drop the mic and,
you can
yeah.
do all that stuff? I
Yeah,
know, it's
totally.
amazing.
Yeah.
Great to see you. So, wait, so you're in LA right now or West Coast?
I'm in LA. I'm at home.
Nice,
I
fantastic.
will warn you that every time I do one of these home interviews, my cats are like relentless. I try to shut the door and then they come and they bang on the door. And, so we might get disturbed here at some point.
It's fine. It's fine. We're gonna make it work. The cat's named after the whiskey and go-go, right?
Yeah, exactly. I realized I interviewed Alex Lifeson recently, and in preparing for that, I was talking to my brother, and who's a giant Rush fan, and the reason that I grew up listening to Rush, and I realized I have a real missed opportunity where I should have named my cats Bitor and Snow Dog, but. Next time. Next time.
Is that episode out yet? Your interview with
It
Alex?
no, the show isn't out yet. It's a new thing that I'm working on and just and doing a bunch of interviews for now. And we're gonna make like a formal announcement soon and start dropping episodes in the summertime. But yeah, it's really fun. It's a different thing from my Walking the Floor podcast, but it's more guitar focused.
Was there something you always wanted to ask Alex that you got the opportunity to ask? Like, what do you ask Alex?
Well, the premise of the show is I'm interviewing guitar players and having them basically teach me one of their, usually it's like one of their, if it's a lead guitar player, it's one of their iconic solos. And if it's somebody, I interviewed Nile Rodgers and I interviewed Blake from Jawbreaker just yesterday. And those guys are like not, ex not known for their lead guitar work exactly. So we went over other, the riffs and the chords and stuff like that. So, but yeah, it's basically like whoever I'm interviewing is teaching me how to play one of their songs, essentially.
This is
So
just
that,
so this is an excuse for you to just get guitar lessons
100
from these
million
people.
percent.
Yeah. Yeah,
Yes. And that's
exactly.
why, and it's not genre focused at all. It's like all over the shop. Like I've interviewed Rivers from Weezer, Lindsey L, Charlie from Blackberry Smoke, Blake, Nile Rodgers, Alex Lifeson. I interviewed Richie Sambora. He taught me the guitar solo for Wanted Dead or Alive. And I've got a bunch of other interviews, great folks lined up that I won't mention now because I haven't done them. But it's going to be really good. Like it's going to have be a wide range of guitar styles.
Do you get a different nuance learning from him? Because I feel like that's a solo, the Richie Sambora solo, for example. Like, I feel like you could listen and kind of pick out that solo and probably get pretty
Sure,
close. But when he
but
teaches it,
it's
do you get different nuances?
with all of them, yeah, because really there's so much to eat to any guitar player has their little subtleties and nuances. With every single one of them so far has been eye-opening. In
Yeah.
just the little things, and that's the stuff you miss, like when you're just figuring it out by ear. That's the stuff that's harder to kind of figure out, or even like watching. I've sort of my the way that I figure stuff out in the modern age is a few different things. I listen to the record, whatever it is, and just try to see if I can figure it out from that. I'll look for video footage on YouTube of whoever it is actually playing it live, if you can find it, and just kind of see where their hands are at. And then, it's 2023. There's like almost any song you could think of. There's like 100 different people on YouTube explaining how to play it, but they all explain it. There's a lot of people that get pretty close, but it's not like exactly right. And Exactly right. Doesn't really even matter to me that much, but it is fun to sit and see, like how people really did this, these little movements, you know, that make a, that it's like you don't quite register, but you feel it in some weird way. I mean, I've always been the type of person as a player that I just like to like try to learn the spirit of a song or a guitar solo or something more than the actual, like, I have to learn every single note and know it exactly. But it is super fun to like see what the person actually did, you know what I mean? And
Was that
then you can mess it up in your own way.
a progression? Like, I remember when I was a young guitar player, I was obsessed with learning everything note for note, and I would spend like an hour being like, what is that one little thing? And then as I've gotten older, I've been like, I don't really care as much as long as I kind of get the feeling of it or the vibe of it. Like, was that a progression for you where you like at some point you're like, whatever, like, let me just play the feel of this and we're good here?
I mean, I was never much somebody that would learn anything note for note when I was really young, but the sort of the turning point for me was when we started doing those Me First and the Gimme Gimmes records, because we would sit there and figure out these songs, you know, these all cover songs, and we'd figure out these songs, and I was really stuck in like, this is how the song goes. You not so much note for note, but like, this is the structure of the song and it has to be played this way because this is how Billy Joel played it and we have to do it, you know, in the exact same structure. And it was really Fat Mike that would just always be like, no, we don't. We can do it however we want, you know, we can change the chords and we would, you know what I mean? And that was like, that kind of changed my perception of like, you know, it's fun to try to do stuff close to the record, but it's also fun to just mess it up and you know, in a loud barroom environment, and you're like, nobody cares as long as they're having a good time, you know?
There was, you know, you played in Taylor Hawkins' like heavy metal band, or he had like a shred band,
Oh, Chevy Metal,
Chevy Metal. And there was a moment where I guess you were like, you felt like your heavy metal chops weren't up to snuff or whatever. So you took some
Oh,
lessons
yeah.
from Paul Gilbert.
I did, yeah, I
And
did.
what, first of all, I feel this way too, because I feel like I'm a competent guitar player for what it's worth, but like I'm not comfortable playing Van Halen tunes or shredding or doing any of that. So I relate to
Well,
you on this. But what does Paul teach you? What does Paul Gilbert teach you?
God, I would have to go back and look at what those lessons were. Although I don't think I had like a video. That was like way before Zoom and all that stuff, so I don't have any record of it. He taught me, you know, like you're right. It was at that point when I was playing in Chevy Metal, and for the first time, like I never learned Van Halen songs and that type of stuff when I was a kid because I just couldn't play like that. And I, you know, to be perfectly frank, still can't play like that.
Yeah, I
But
always
I
thought as I
wanted.
got older, I would just magically know how to play those songs, and then that never
Yeah.
happened.
No, what happens is you get older and you just magically care less about nailing it.
Yes, that.
And you know, somebody, a player like Eddie Van Halen, it's like nobody can really do what he did. So like, that's the classic example. Like, just get into the wheelhouse and the spirit. Maybe look where his hands are and try to do something that's kind of high speed. And so that's what I was doing. But you're right. Like I was like, I periodically go through phases like this where like I'm gonna learn, you know, how to really like do like crazy alternate picking super fast stuff. And I would shed on that stuff for a little bit and never get it really down. And then kind of go, you get care, you know, you just get busy with something else and you forget for a while. And then you come back to it. It's kind of like the same way I periodically sit down and try to learn how to play pedal steel. And I'll sit there and I'll work through a couple things and kind of get it going and not really going because that's also like impossible. And then you just get, you know, if I'm like, if Foo Fighters are busy, if I'm busy with my, you know, solo stuff, if I'm busy with my podcast, if I'm like writing songs, then I just like that part of my brain shuts down and I just focus on other stuff. But yeah, my main memory of taking, I don't remember if it was one or two lessons from Paul Gilbert, was that he was just really cool, man. He was a really nice guy. I'd never met him before. You know, he's obviously a phenomenal guitar player, and I probably should have stuck with that. Maybe I'd have better chops now.
But when you learn like a Van Halen song, are you learning it with like a slow downer and are you doing it by ear or are you watching a YouTube video and seeing what a million other people have done with, say, Eruption or whatever it is?
All of the above. Yeah. I mean, I have that amazing slower downer app. And I've had that for years and I love that. The problem with slowing stuff down for rock music, it's great now because you can find isolated tracks on, you know, out on the internet. And that's, if you can find an isolated track for something, that that helps a lot. But when you're slowing down like a, like an Ozzy Osbourne song, you know, and trying to figure out a Randy Rhoads thing, first off, those solos are like probably, you know, triple tracked or something. So there's like, you've got all these, you know, they're not exactly perfect things lining up. And when you slow that down, it starts to create these weird sounds that almost make it more confusing in a way. And you have the music that it's sitting over, which is also starts to get all, and like, you know, that makes it, and it just turns into this sort of soupy sludge, you know what I mean? So yeah, if you can find, the isolated tracks, that's the best. You know, it's a real, it's Randy Rhoads, it's, that's the hardest one because there's so little footage of him playing those songs, and a lot of those songs they probably never played live off those two albums that he did, and so it's, you can't find a lot of footage of him actually playing live to see where he's, where his hands are, and it's Richter fast, and like I said, triple tracked or whatever, quadruple tracked. And they're all kind of varying a little bit. So it's hard to know like exactly what he did, but there's some folks out there on the internet that get pretty close probably. And you know, a lot of that stuff for me is like, it's like, you basically have to like relearn to play guitar, and I'm just too old and set in my ways to do that. You know, as much as I would love to.
I know this, I feel like I'm never going to be a great shredder. And then I see someone do it, and I go, oh God, I should work on that, because how great would it be to have 25% of that? But then it's like, you never get it.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of like, I was a few years ago, I was in a swim group here at home. You know, it's like a swim training class, because I like to swim, swim laps, and it's great. And I was talking to the coach, because everybody in the in those classes was like people that do triathlons. And I'd never done one. I still never done one. And I was talking to him about it, and I was like, oh man, that sounds fun. I'd really like to try that. And he goes, I remember the coach just goes, yeah, but you know, look at all these people. Like, are you really like, you're going to invest that much time to what? Be like the 300th guy in the triathlon? Like, who cares? And that's kind of how I feel about learning to shred. It's like, am I really going to invest all that time and that to get, and I don't know, man, I just, I do what I do, and it's worked out.
Is there a frontier that you think about, like maybe it is the shred space, or are you like, this, I got a bag of tricks, and like that's great?
Oh no, I mean, I, you know, I love learning, so that's like why I'm starting this new show. I love learning stuff. I feel like for all, for like, you could sit down and woodshed on like 50 ripping licks, and you're going to maybe really, really internalize one or two of them and actually incorporate it into what you do. At least for me, you know, maybe that's not for anybody else, but for me, you know, I'll sit and I'll watch, like, you know, I've got like a giant stack of instructional DVDs and stuff, and work through some of that stuff, and you'll work through a whole DVD, and you'll really only, you know, it's like only a couple things really make it into what you do. And I'm the type of player that if I don't just do it over and over and over and over and a million times, then I don't really learn it. So I have to figure out a way to actually get it into my playing. And then, you know, little bits and bobs stick along the way. So, I mean, I love, like, don't get me wrong, I love always kind of learning and always evolving. And I feel like, you know, I'm a much player, more well-rounded guitar player now than I was when I was 18 or something, but I can't play like I did when I was 18 because I just don't have that spark anymore, you know what I mean? Like, it's, I'm a different thing now than I was, I'm a different thing than I was 10 years ago or 20 years ago, you know what I mean? And I can't do, I couldn't comfortably go play a set with No Use for a Name right now. I could probably work up to it, but I don't have that coordination anymore, because you know what I mean, I just haven't done it for so long, like that would, I would have to learn it again, you know.
One of my favorite guitar players is Don Rich, who I know you love also. Those licks, like, I feel like I've learned so many licks from so many guitar players, but learning those Don Rich licks, even though they're so simple, those licks stick with me. Like, I think about those all the time, even if I'm doing something fast or whatever. Like, that's, to me, he's like the BB King of country music, which is maybe insane to say.
Yeah,
but it's like, you hear that stuff everywhere. It's so simple. Like, did you sit down and learn all those little things and those solos? And was that stuff that really stuck with you?
Yes and no. I mean, I certainly have played through many, many Buckaroo songs over the years. And I mean, Don Rich is such an interesting player because, you know, most of those songs, you know, it's like it's that 60s honky tonk country style. So it's most of it's like big cowboy chords, open chords, you know, it's all 1-4-5 kind of chord progressions. And there's Don Rich playing almost everything in a minor pentatonic scale over that, you know, whereas most people would be leaning more on like the major pentatonic and throwing in like the flat seven and the minor third and all that sort of those sort of moves. And he does that, sure. But like, and he'll bend that minor third, kind of give it a little style tweak up to the major third, you know what I mean? Just, but it's all that, all that stuff. It's weird. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, he was really kind of like, oh, he was a one of a kind. Nobody really, he's another guy that like is, you listen to it and you go, man, that's so easy. And then you try to play it and you're like, how the fuck is he doing that? You know, like it is not easy, man. That's where like personality and style come into it, I think.
And even tonally, like I would try to get that Woody Telecaster tone out of my telly. I'm like, it sounds too clean, even though it sounds like a bridge pickup and something like he's got this grit to it.
Okay. I don't know if this is true, but this is what I was told. Cause I had that conversation a long time ago with my friend Eddie that plays guitar in the Mavericks. Cause he's he knows that style inside and out, and as a master of it. And I was like, God, man, I've got a telly, I've got a deluxe reverb, I'm playing these songs, I'm playing the licks. Why the fuck doesn't it sound like those guys? And he said, because those guys in that era were all playing flat wound strings.
Is that what?
I don't know. I mean, you know, that's what Eddie told me. I don't know who told him that, but I've got some flat wound strings and strung up my telly, and it does sound great, and it sounds a lot more like that thing. So I don't know, maybe that's it.
I also felt like it was the half step thing, like weren't they tuned down a half step, and that
I think so,
something that's like but like I've spent endless time trying to learn those records, and they're so silly, like they don't sound that crazy, but they're unbelievable.
Well, if you look at their recorded output, the Buckaroos recorded so much music. Like, you get that box set of the Capitol years or whatever, and it's just millions and millions of songs. And you know, so the story goes, Buck was like a real taskmaster, and you know, you couldn't get a second take or whatever, so you had to have that stuff wired. So I feel like that's that, and you know, maybe that's like a classic example of like they had their thing, they had their. This is like these are the handful of things that we're going to do on any given song, and you gotta have that shit wired, because you're, you know, if you make a mistake that third take, like you're getting fined,
you're done.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Oh my god,
because they're all kind of a certain formula, you know what I mean? But they recorded like gazillions of them.
Yeah, like there's so many Don Rich solos that are like basically the same but like a little different, and it's like you could tell like what he's thinking. Like once you learn that bag of tricks, it's like you sort of know what he's going to do, and that's like putting the puzzle pieces together with it.
Yeah, for sure. Then you've got Merle Haggard's guitar playing. You know, all these guys were around at the, you know, each other at
Roy
the
Nichols.
Same time.
Yeah.
Roy Nichols, totally different guitar player. You know what I mean? Like, and you look at those records, and probably the Buck records too, I don't know, but like those Merle records from that same era, like mid-60s, late-60s. And the lineup of guitar players he would have on his stuff. But Roy Nichols, I think Roy Nichols was the guy that was just like playing a guitar solo from start to finish. You know what I mean? On a lot of the songs.
Right.
What? Like, how do you do that? Like, how do you even learn that? And when you take that out of the song, you really miss it, you know?
Do you like, I remember when I got into this genre and it felt like such a breath of fresh air of just a totally different style of playing from anything that you were hearing, that I was hearing in like classic rock or alt rock, like the open string licks and the chicken picking. Like, is that kind of what happened to you? Like, were you sort of like, I feel like I know every classic rock riff, and then this was like a new frontier of repertoire to learn?
I mean, I never felt like I knew every classic
rock.
Sure. I'm still learning them, but it was definitely a new frontier and tonally so different. That was like the part that, because, you know, like honky tonk and rock and roll are pretty closely related musically in a lot of ways, you know. And I like you could take like a Angus Young guitar solo from just about any song, and if you ran that through a different amp setup and maybe a Tele through a Princeton reverb or something
and
with
made
no
it major.
Gain, you know. Yeah, I mean, and then you're kind of in the same wheelhouse, you know, same type of licks. And everybody's cross-pollinating anyway, because country guys love rock and rock guys love country, and you know, it's all kind of feeding off each other. But yeah, it was not playing with humbuckers and not having a big wall of gain and volume and sustain to fall back. It's very, very humbling.
Yeah, that's how I feel. This new song that you just put out recently, Blacktop White Lines, I feel like this could be like
has a wall of gain and volume.
I was about to say that actually, which actually sounds the opposite.
None of that applies. None of that applies to my.
None of that applies
there.
But talking about the song, because this
went back to my comfort zone. Yeah,
you were like, give me one song on the record with the Marshals or whatever it is, the Freedmans. Yeah. What is this? Could be like a Brothers Osborne hit. Like this thing sounds so good.
Well, there you go.
We wrote it.
With John Osborne and Jaron. Yeah, so there you go.
So does he, because
in that wheel,
I think, did Jaron come in with that riff and he sort of had that kind of funky thing?
He did. Yeah. He had a demo of that riff and was just kind of like scatting stuff over it. And we were like, oh, great. Jaron did the heavy lifting. We got a song.
Yeah. We got to
come up with some words, you know? Yeah.
But it's clever. Like, it's actually a really clever song. It's like a fun little story told very concisely. It's like two verses. And it's like, oh my God, I've got a whole world here. That's been painted.
Oh, right on. Oh, nice. Yeah, thank you. Well, that's, you know, that's always the hard part, is to get those ideas in there, you know, without laboring the point too much, you know. Because you can, it's so easy to all of a sudden you've got like four verses written and half a chorus, and you're like, wait, what the fuck are we doing? But we, you know, that one kind of shaped up to be like, it's kind of like turning a murder ballad on its head a little bit, you know.
How do you meet John Osborne? Like, I feel like he would be one of your favorite current guitar players right now.
Oh, he is. He is. I mean, he's a beast. I love that guy's guitar playing, and it's always great when you're a fan of somebody and then you get to know them a little bit, and they're like every bit as cool as you hope they would be. You know, I mean, he's just such a sweet dude. I actually ran into him on a flight out to Nashville recently. Just randomly, we both happened to be sitting like across the aisle from each other. And this, from the moment he walked onto the plane, we're just, you know, just talking shop, talking guitars, you know.
How'd you meet him for the first time? Like, who put you in touch with him?
I feel like the first time I met John and TJ was, I think, when I interviewed them for Walking the Floor, which was years ago out in Nashville. And who put me in contact? It probably would have been Kendall Marvel, I think, probably put me in contact with him. But I don't honestly remember now. But let's just say that it was Kendall, because that would sound about right, because he's tight with them and writes with them a lot. And they came over to my hotel room where I was staying, and I interviewed them. And they were just so funny and cool and easy to, you know, just a good hang, and just stayed contact with them over the years. So yeah,
and this record sounds like a hit for them. Like, I'm surprised he didn't want to cut it.
Let's hope that they do, man.
Let's hope that they do.
Let's start that petition right now.
Who's playing on this? Are you doing the guitars on this? Because I know Tom Bukovac played a little on this record on that song.
There's a bunch of us. There's a bunch of guitar players on there. So on the first two songs that we cut, we cut the whole record over the course of like three main sessions. You know, I would go out to Nashville and record the basic tracks, and then I'd take that home and add, you know, guitar solos or whatever, and send it back to Jaron, and Jaron would take it home and he'd tweak on it and add harmony vocals and stuff. And then little by little over the course of a year or so, we got that thing done. But in that first session, the first session we did was we recorded Blacktop White Lines and we recorded Dead and Gone, which I only thought about afterwards. Those are the first two songs that we put out off it. So those two songs kind of like were like, you know, my first experience working with Jaron as a producer, and really you know, like sonically kind of different than anything I'd done before, and just kind of like pointed the way to maybe where what we're gonna do with this record. Kind of like, you know, like anchor songs on the record. And yeah, so in that session, guitar playing wise, I'm playing guitar, Bukovac's playing guitar, and Charlie Worsham's doing all
Like
the
dobro, right?
anything that, well, anything that's acoustic, you know, acoustic guitar, dobro, banjo, mandolin, whatever, you know, any of that stuff is all Charlie. So there's a lot. It was really cool tracking with them too, because I never tracked like that with that many guitar players all playing on the session. And those guys would be like mixing up. You know, I'm sitting there just struggling trying to nail my part down, and those guys every couple of takes are changing what they're doing. And before too long, you know, you've got a lot of options and a lot of cool guitar stuff that I just wouldn't never have thought of or played. Or, you know, it's cool. It's cool to have that all kind of together working off each other. But I think you really hear it in Dead and Gone, you know, where there's like, you've got, I've got that crazy micropog on my telly. So it's just all nasty and fucked up. And you're not really supposed to play chords with that, but I'm playing chords and it's all janky and sounds
Yeah.
like a synth and it's, you know, resonating all weird. And then, Charlie's on the dobro on that song, and you've got Bukovac playing all that like kind of like swampy, it's like a tremolo or something on it, wah wah wah, that all that business. Yeah, and they just all kind of work together, you know, and we're all kind of sitting, you know, obviously sitting in very different places, and it's cool. It's that cool stuff that you can't plan, or you don't plan, and you just go into the studio and it just happens because you've got great players on the track, you know.
Did you pick, I mean, those guys are ace guys, of course, you can't go wrong with them, but like, did you have a relationship with them, or was there a reason you picked those guys, Charlie and Tom? Or like, does Jaron pull them in and you go, let's do it? Like, how do you end up with those two guys to share the
I
duty
think,
of guitar?
yeah, I mean, I knew Charlie and Bukovac before that session, and of course love their playing, but I think Jaron pulled them in. And then when he told me, I was stoked because I just, you know, they're just fantastic and just cool dudes, you know, to be in the studio with.
Yeah, right. When your tour rig right now, I was looking, it's no amps. You've got the Strymon Iridium,
Yes.
which is exactly what I'm using on fly dates. But I try
Oh, for real?
absolutely. But I
Yeah.
just bring my pedal board and my Iridium, which is the most freeing thing ever, because it's like I've got a
Yes.
whole rig in my suitcase with my guitar.
I'll tell you, it's kind of funny because now I've built this monster. You can see it on that episode of that pedal show that I did recently. You can
Yeah.
see the whole thing and all its gory detail. It's my pedal board for my solo thing is so big now, it's like bringing an amp with you. I have it in like a giant Pelican. It's a little less like, I mean, you know, it's still, I love that thing. I love that gig rig switcher makes it all work. And also the I've got on there that Walrus Audio Canvas stereo DI,
Yeah.
so I can have all my, like, you know, stereo delays and all that stuff. Which is super fun. But yeah, I love it, man. It's, you know, I've got like real quick, I was messing around. I had some people build me an Ableton rig for live with the idea in mind that I was looking for a way, because I go out and do like proper solo shows, just me and an acoustic guitar, like from time to time. And I always get a little bored at those with, because I can't really play like guitar solos and stuff, and I just wanted to have something to be able to play against. So I was trying to figure out a way. We stemmed out all my records and loaded this thing up, and I was just kind of messing with it at my studio and trying to figure out, well, how could I, what could I use for my records to kind of play against and figure out a way to make that cool and work. And then there were some times where, like, you know, my bass player was busy with something else, and me and the drummer would rehearse, and we'd be like, well, let's just turn on the track rig and see how the, you know, we can just play along to that, you know. And
Yeah.
so we had luckily done that a little bit. And then I was in the middle of doing shows in December, and my bass player and my pedal steel player both got COVID. So all of a sudden we were halfway through the shows and you know, lost half the band. So we just jumped into it. And we just went, well, this wasn't exactly what we were planning on doing, but we've got this thing, you know what I mean? It's either cancel the shows or figure this out real quick. So we just did it. And after a couple of shows, I was like, you know what? Let's, if I'm already on in-ears and I'm already listening to a click and I got to be on a click with the Ableton and all the stuff, and we're doing that whole thing. So let's see how this works. And we don't have a bassist on stage or a pedal steel player. Let's see how it works if I also don't have an amp. And so I've stuck the Iridium on there. And I loved it because for that type of setup, especially like for my solo thing, I'm playing small clubs, your amps to me never sound good in my in-ears, you know? Yeah. It just never does. You're like, you know, nothing against local sound people, but like you're always like, I don't bring like a sound person out generally. And so you're kind of at the mercy of whoever just happens to be there. And it would always sound really rough, and getting that to sit right was hard. So having the Iridium, just it's like your amp is just like beamed into your brain, you know. It's so good.
Why not do like a
I was gonna say, so real quick, I just, you know, I went to the dark side and I'm not coming back, man. You know, to be honest, like on a van tour, man, you need that. That's nice to have that extra space in the van that's not taken up by my two, you know, my
Twin
two
reverbs
deluxe reverbs or whatever. Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah.
What did you try a bunch of amp sims? Because I tried probably 3 or 4, and then I was like, the Iridium to me sounded the best by far and played the best.
The Iridium appealed to me the most for a couple of reasons. First off, the 3 amps that it's bundled with those are the 3 amps that I go to. You know, it's a deluxe reverb, it's an AC30, and it's a Marshall. And yeah, those are the 3 types of amps that I play. It's like they designed that thing just aimed at me. Plus, it's this big.
Yeah.
And it's just got knobs like an amp. So you don't have to like learn some entirely new, you don't have to program anything or learn some new language. It's just the simplicity and the specific amps that it comes with. And then the sound, to me, it just sounds amazing. I mean, it's blasphemous to say, but when you're dealing with like dirty power and you know, your amp not being mic'd up right, it sounds better a lot of the time. I mean, let's just be honest. It does. It sounds better.
I was blown away, especially like for me, like I'll fly and we'll have backline stuff. And it's like, you never know what kind of backline deluxe reverb or what you're going to get backline.
It ain't going to be good though.
It's not going to be good.
Oh, I brought you my vintage 65. That's, you know, that's totally cherry. Yes. That ain't your backline.
You know? It's like the amp that hasn't been serviced in 10 years. Like that's the amp you get. Like,
yeah.
So it's like the Strymon. I did maybe like 10 or 15 dates with it last year. And I was like, it also made me so happy that I was like, I'm fully self-contained. Like I've got my flyboard and a guitar and I'm ready to play a gig.
Yep.
Like that blows my mind.
Oh dude. I just toured the UK and did, you know, some shows over there, and I brought 2 tellies and my pedal board. That was it.
Boom. You're ready to rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Simple. Yeah.
When you joined the Foo Fighters, you were 28 years old. Did you kind of feel like my whole life is falling apart and I'll never do anything great and like I'm too old to become a rock star? Like that's not that old, but I feel like when you're 28, you're freaking out about that, right? Is that what you were feeling at that time?
Honestly, kind of in a way. And it's funny because when I look back at that time period, this first few years of being in the Foo Fighters, and even when I see pictures, I look like I'm 16 or something, you know, and I in my mind I'm like a kid, but I really wasn't. Like I was a full-grown, you know, adult human, but like, and had been for quite a while, you know. So it's funny because I was playing in No Use for a Name, like, because it's sort of trajectory of my life back then was that I had moved to LA when I was 18 and like tried to make it and do all that stuff, played around in bands, and nothing ever really worked out. And then I moved up to San Francisco in the mid 90s and joined No Use for a Name, and then, you know, started like making records and going on tour and doing that whole thing. But I was beginning to feel that thing that you feel where you're like, well, you know, the writing was kind of on the wall that scene and your sort of band's popularity or whatever was like diminishing, and some this new stuff was coming up and that scene was beginning to fade a little bit, you know, so you like I was aware of that. And that that period right there, right before I joined Foos, like I had dropped out of high school and never went to college, and I remember I went to, like, took like a full load of classes at City College up in San Francisco, and was just kind of thinking I wasn't seriously thinking about like quitting the band or any kind of like radical life change or anything, but I was just kind of beginning to feel that thing, like, you know what comes next, you know? And not like in a bad way, not in a negative way, but like, you know, I was stoked. I was had made some records, I'd done some tours. I certainly didn't feel like, you know, oh gee shucks, this is terrible, you know, like, but I didn't think that something like Foo Fighters was ever going to come along at that point, you know what I mean? I mean, you know, rock and roll's game, and I was, like you said, I wasn't exactly young anymore, you know. So that's the reality of that. And then luckily I joined a band with a bunch of people that I was all, you know, we're all like a little, you know, we're all seasoned a little bit at that point, you
yeah,
know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
Yeah. When, so it was perfect.
When you joined the band, did you instantly feel like your position was secure, or did you feel like,
fuck like, no, are you crazy?
Like, when did you feel like what, like, first of all, did you feel
like,
I
don't feel like that now.
You don't feel like, I that mean, now?
I'm,
how's that
I'm
possible?
Not, I'm just, because I'm not hardwired to feel that way. I just do not. That's not how I am. That's not what I am. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If like, yeah, we, I like, I can rationalize that, like, you know, it's been a long time and like, that there is some level of security or whatever, but I just don't think like, I'm just so hardwired to think like, oh my God, this is all going to go away and I'm going to get a job at Starbucks and fuck, you know, what am I going to do now? You know, I don't know. That's like, I wish I could let that go, but I can't.
At least you'd be a manager at a Starbucks. You probably wouldn't be working the
yeah,
front line.
That's right. I'd step right into management. I tell you, that was one of the funniest jobs I ever had. I had a lot of goofy jobs in my younger years. And when I was in No Use for a Name, like it was sort of like being a full-time musician, except that we just didn't make that much money. So I would come home from tour and within a couple of months, you know, I'd have to go get a job delivering pizzas or whatever. And I got a job at this little coffee shop of, you know, this was just before Starbucks had really taken over the world, but it was like that kind of thing. But it was this little, it was kind of like a bakery coffee shop. And part of the job was you, like, people would order cakes and you'd have to, like, you know, write like "Happy Birthday, Larry" on it or whatever.
Yeah,
and
right.
Isaac, which I could never do, and I was just a terrible employee at that point. I didn't care. It was just something to fill the, you know, I just needed to pay rent before the next tour, kind of thing. And I was like probably like 27 or 26 or something, you know, by then. And I remember the woman that was like the manager was like pretty young and maybe in college. And she would just be so mad at me all the time because I was just the worst employee. And I would just be getting rung up every day by like a 19-year-old, you know? And I'd just be like, I just can't get her. I'm sorry. I can't do the icing. I'm trying. I just can't do it. You know?
I don't think I could do it either. I'd be horrible at that.
No,
bad.
It's hard.
Handwriting with a pen and a pencil, you know? I can't even do that,
yeah,
let alone,
yeah,
cake.
Yeah.
Did you feel like...
I'm sorry I'm late again. But
yes.
I'm still drunk from last night. What do you want from me?
What do you want me? I'm trying to sober up here.
Yeah.
Come on. This
yeah,
I
was
my
at
fault.
The Swingin' Utters show at the Trocadero, and I'm still technically pretty drunk. So, but I made it.
But I made it. Of course the writing, yeah, on the cake is not going to be clean. So what do you want from me? Come on.
Right.
Did you feel like you were, like, looking back on yourself, though, do you feel like you had to shed a lot to become, like, now I listen to you and, like, you're so good. When you joined the Foos, do you feel like you were a good enough guitar player to truly be in that band, or do you think something else pushed you into that band?
I mean, I certainly had to adapt, you know, for you, like, I think what it's interesting, even before Foos, like, what I never really thought about or cared much about rhythm guitar playing. I just never thought about it. I did it, you know, like as a teenager and stuff, but I was always thought of myself as like wanting to be a lead guitar player, and that was really where my energy went. And so when I joined No Use for a Name, I had to adapt to that, which made me, you know, there were guitar solos in No Use for a Name, but it was, you know, it was a lot of doing all that like really fast stuff. So I had to figure out how to do that and kind of throw myself into that. And then even with the Gimme Gimmes, you know, was I had to work on my rhythm playing. And when I joined Foos, the differences were A, I hadn't played in a band that was like at those tempos for a while. You know what I mean? So I had to figure out what to do with myself as a player when you're not going like all that sort of thing. Because it's more space, you know, in
Yeah,
your
right.
playing. And there were like no guitar solos in the Foo Fighters. And you know, this is like coming out of the 90s where like guitar solos had gotten pretty illegal. So just sort of you just had to adapt, you know, focus more on your rhythm playing. And then even like, you know, having some delays and some effects and things and some mellower tones and not having, like we talked about before, that big wall of gain and everything. So it just made me I think ultimately like I never doubted that I could do it or anything. Like I didn't feel like, oh my God, this is so hard. But it was like the hard part is like learning a whole, you know, 3 albums worth of material and being able to play it confidently, you
Yeah.
know, but it wasn't like, you know, the emphasis in our band has never been on polished perfection. That's not what we are. So there was no expectation of like you have to come in and play this absolutely freaking perfect like the record. It was never that, you know what I mean?
Right.
And still isn't that, you know. So it's like it was always more, you know, just a looser thing than that.
Didn't Taylor give you some advice where didn't he say like your job here is to find your own lane, or what did he say, find
Yeah,
your own
yeah,
space in
yeah.
the band?
Totally. Yeah, exactly.
What did he tell you?
It was something like that. I wish I could remember exactly because it was wise words, and I definitely like really tried to apply it. Like he's something to the effect of, like make yourself an asset here, or, you know, something like that. Like do something. The basic idea was like you get like what you just said. Like you got to find your own space and hold it down. You know.
What do you think that is like in that? And is it, I feel like you're sort of the most lead solo player, but maybe that's not true in that band. Is that what you would
Yeah,
say
I
your
mean,
role is,
there's,
or?
yeah, for sure. But there isn't a ton of guitar solo stuff. But like, I think that has also evolved over the years. Where like, you know, if you look at like my pedal board versus Pat and Dave's pedal board, I got
Yeah.
like the whole world on it. You know, I got everything on it, and I've sort of like I don't know, I've become I'm not like super duper effect guy, but like that's if there's gonna be some delays bouncing around or a flange on, it's probably gonna be me. You know what I mean?
They give
More
you
than
the
there's
effects stuff.
yeah, like the color guy, you
Pat
know.
and Dave, they just don't want the pedal boards. They just throw it all on you.
That's right. Dave in particular keeps his pedal board very clean and simple. He's got a
Yeah.
couple things.
Yeah. You're the guy who does it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's funny because we've all our gear has been, you know, we're getting ready to do shows and stuff. So we're all sort of like, you know, switching up our gear a little bit here and there. And
Yeah.
I just had Dave Friedman just built me an insane new pedal board that I'm just in love with right now. It's very cool.
So someone, you're definitely not going to give me the exclusive, but there is a drummer playing with you guys in these rehearsals, I'm assuming. Or maybe
I
not.
can't get in.
Can't
Can't
get
get into
into
that.
it. Can't get
I
into
just
it.
say it's I'm so hesitant to, and not because I don't want to, but because you know, it's just the world we live in that everything you say gets turned into clickbait and not by you, but by like, you know, but by other people, or intentionally misinterpreted to mean something that you never said or meant or whatever. So I'm just really hesitant to talk about any specific Foo Fighter stuff, you know, but like, you know, we're going to be hitting the road soon. So
Can't wait. Can't
stay
wait.
tuned.
Stay
Yeah.
tuned. Can't wait. No, that's, yeah, of course. Solo career, solo albums coming out. Lost at Sea. When's the actual album coming out?
The album comes out in October. Yeah. But we've got, and we just put out the second track, Dead and Gone, and then there's a couple more tracks coming out before the album comes out. And if you sign up for my email list,
Yeah, plug
kids,
the email
you
list.
get,
Let's
yeah,
go.
well, you get, you'll get a, you'll also, there's a another unreleased track that gets sent to you right away. And you can find that, you can sign up on my website.
Blacktop White Lines. I listened to this thing like 10 times. It was
Oh,
so
nice.
fun. You gotta go listen. If you're listening to this, you gotta go listen to Blacktop White Lines. It
Yes,
sounds like a
please
Brothers
do.
Osborne hit, but it's like different. It
Yeah.
sounds like Chris Shiflett. It's unbelievable.
It's like a Brothers Osborne hit if Brothers Osborne were worse singers.
Yeah. Do you think like Seth Godin has this really great quote where he's like, people always say like you should do what you would do if you knew you wouldn't fail. And he always says, like, I like to say, what would I do if I knew I would fail? And those are the things you should really do in life. With this solo project, like, I mean, the music's so good. You played the rhyme in opening for Blackberry Smoke. Like, you're having massive success. But is this the kind of thing where you're like, I'm trying to headline like Ryman's and theaters and maybe even bigger than that? Or are you like, if this fails, I'm just doing it for the creative outlet and the music? Like, is that enough of a reason? Or are you like, hey, let's push this and let's make this like really fucking big?
You know, with my solo stuff, I mean, the thing that I never am able to really do is like, I've never put out a record and toured it for 2 years. You know what I mean? So I'm always sort of getting in shows in the cracks. So it's definitely gotten better over the years. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, like well into, I mean, I'm sure it'll still happen, but like, you know, dude, I'll go out and if I try to go out on tour, it's like, you got to play somewhere on a Tuesday night and you're probably playing like a C market and there's like 25 people there. So like it ain't easy. So, you know, it's like, would I like to be able to sell more tickets? Of course. You know what I mean? Of course. No question. But, I'm also, probably overly seasoned and cynical about how things work. And, you know, so if you're not going to like jump in your van and go tour it for the, you know, tour it hard for the next 2 years, it's hard to build that. But so I don't worry about it. You know what I mean? I've got a pretty busy life as it is, with my family and with foos and stuff. So that's all full time stuff. So I just try to enjoy the shows, you know, and I like, it's a different outlet of my guitar playing. It's a different outlet of my songwriting and singing and doing all that stuff. And it's just super fun. If, you know, hey man, if we could sell a few hundred more tickets per city, sign me up, baby.
Is it hard to be a rock star dad? Because it's like, you dropped out of high school, you know, it's like you had this audition. Now you're in the biggest band in the world. Like, I've heard you say something interesting, which is when you talk to your kids, you always say, I'm going to work, or not like I'm going to the gig, I'm going to the studio. Like, they have to give you so much shit. Like, or do you catch them like drinking or doing high school things? And how do you like, how do you have any authority on them? Like, I feel like they hold this over you. They must.
You're getting into my weak spot right here. It is so hard, man. It's so hard because, you know, I'm a modern dad, man. My kids know everything about me, and they know I'm a high school dropout. They know what my past is and all that stuff. And I'm really proud to say my kids are just so much smarter than I was at that age, and they're so much better, just better people and wiser and you know, have better heads on their shoulders than I ever did when I was at those same respective ages. So, it's hard sometimes when you're ringing them up for not doing their homework and they're like, Dad, you dropped out of high school. How would you even know? Or like, you know, something like, you know, you're trying to remind them to do their chemistry homework and they're like, Dad, you never even took chemistry.
Yeah. Like how, what
do you don't know, you don't know anything about this. And I'd be like, okay, but I do know that you should do your homework. That I know.
Is your wife the one who helps with that, or is she?
Both do. I mean, my wife. My wife did graduate high school, and
went to college.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
and went to college. She's a doctor.
Yeah, so she does have authority to say that. But yeah, no, it's you know, you can always fall back on, I don't want you to be like me, man. You don't want to be this.
But what are you talking about? I feel like you would want to be this. This is good. This is a good thing you got going here.
Well, none of them really seem to have, like, you know, my youngest is still playing, has gotten really into playing guitar recently. But I don't know that any of them will pursue music or anything. So, I don't know how much my life or my working life or whatever is going to be much of an influence to them beyond just, you know, work hard and grind it out, you know, like that they can definitely take from what I've done, you know. That's pretty universal.
Yeah, that's the dream, though, to like show your kids some riffs, though, or like to go guitar shopping with them, or like to, you know, fun.
You know what's fun is, like, with my youngest, like I said, he's really into guitar, so like it's guitar shopping is a little different than it was. Like I never went guitar shopping. I just had one guitar, you know. There was no guitar shopping, but for guitar shopping for my 15-year-old is he goes, do you have a Flying V? I go, yeah, I got a couple. He goes, can I Can you bring it home? I'm like, totally. So bring that thing home, or bring home a Strat, or bring home a Explorer, or bring home a Les Paul, you know, all that kind of stuff. Hey, let me bring home a pedal board so you can mess around with this stuff, you know? So that's guitar shopping in the Shiplet house, which is
where
fun.
Do you bring it home from? Like the Foo Fighters warehouse or?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God. If you were my dad growing up, it would have been incredible. It would have been unbelievable.
At one point I had to buy like soft cases for both my Explorer and my Flying V, which was funny because then he would like take them to school.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah.
What's the story where, like, when you joined the band, Dave just brought you to a guitar store and he was like, you need more guitars. And he just said, buy guitars.
Yeah. Well, I only had one functional guitar at that point. So when we were going out on the road, so, you know, you got to have a backup or two. So we went guitar shopping, man. And still those guitars are still in heavy rotation. That's my white Les Paul and my Explorer.
Yeah. Oh my God. I love it. Okay. Here's like here's a random fan question that I want to know. Maybe you can't answer this, but I've always wondered this. When you travel with the Foos from gig to gig, let's say you're in America, are you on a bus? Do you fly? How do you get from gig to gig?
It really depends on the tour. You know, if it's like, you know, if you're doing a long tour, you know, that's like all kind of in a straight line or whatever, then yeah, you're probably on a bus. If you're, so, you know, but it's a lot of times it'll be plane these days as well.
When you're on the bus, do you ever go into these like small town convenience stores in the middle of nowhere? And because we
yeah,
do this,
of course,
but we do this, and I go, if I was super famous, this would be hilarious. Like, here I am walking into the small town convenience store in the middle of nowhere. It's like, oh my, like, I think about how crazy that would be. Like, do people freak out when you walk into these gas stations?
No, because I'm not Billie Eilish. Like, I mean, you know what I mean? It's probably more the reaction, like, who the fuck is that guy getting off that tour bus?
That's what they say.
Well, I don't know. You know what I mean? It happens. It does happen.
Chris, can't thank you enough for coming on, man. The new record, Lost at Sea, is going to be out in October.
Yes,
and
sir.
Black Top White Lines is out now, which you have to listen to. The song is so good. And Dead and Gone is out too right now from the new record, which is also
yes.
really great. And listen to the
lots of wiggly guitar solos. Lots of wiggly.
You gotta listen to this song. You gotta think about Charlie Warsham and Tom Bukovac and Chris Shiflett trading guitars and licks and they're all in the room making it happen.
That's right. It's all in the soup.
I love it. Okay,
thanks for having me on today.
Absolutely. When you do your podcast, do you obsess over the first question that you're gonna ask someone? Like, is that the most important question?
It can be, because I feel like most of the time when you're doing an interview, you don't necessarily know the person. And you've got that first like 10 or 15 minutes is like, you're sort of feeling each other. Like, is this going to be lighthearted?
Right.
Are we going to be super serious? Like, or, you know, like you're sort of
that
getting
to me
know,
is like,
the
break, right?
Yeah. You're getting to know each other. And then it can, you know, can start to get good. I always find the most important thing though, is to press record before the person gets on the Zoom call, because it's that first interaction is oftentimes when you get the best chit chat.
Oh my God. I learned that so early. Like, I had Billy Gibbons on early. Ooh. And he said the best, most fascinating shit, like right at the beginning, and we weren't recording.
Yeah.
And now,
right.
like,
yeah.
now
yeah.
it's like when I go into a studio to record, I'm like, hey, start recording before I even walk in. Like, just have it running. Like,
oh, dude, when I interviewed Merle Haggard,
that was a great interview.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
It's one that I'm probably the most proud of, just that I got to do it.
Yeah.
But we sat on his bus for probably 2 hours just shooting the shit and him telling stories, and before we did the interview, you know. And then we did the interview, and I was like, oh my God, I wish I'd been running record the whole time, because that was like, you know, just magic.
And then sometimes when you say like, hey, now we're recording now, sometimes your guests like that will freak out versus like,
oh, totally.
Just roll into it. Come on.
Yes.
Right. What do I know?
Yes,
I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah. That's
yeah. It. I'm with you.
Chris, great to see you. Really appreciate you taking the time. And I'm sure I'll see you out on the road somewhere rocking it. So can't wait.
That was fun.